This is an introduction to international trade. This is an old topic in economics, almost a classic topic, but it also has a number of current issues. It's a topic that where the controversy never seems to go away. And we'll have, in separate lectures, I'll discuss some of these specific issues. The issues that come up nowadays include oil, and whether it's a bad thing for the United States to be dependent on foreign oil, outsourcing, which is the use of Indian labor or labor in the Philippines to do service jobs in the United States. So outsourcing generically means taking jobs that, taking work that historically has been done locally because it seemed to be necessary to be local, and because of the internet and better communication, you can take that kind of work and again outsource it, that is, let people who are in other countries do that. Another issue that's currently a hot item is immigration. There's a lot of nativist sentiment out there in the country, people who don't want to see immigration, and that's really in part a trade issue. There are other aspects to it, but it has a international trade aspect to it. And finally, a current issue is China. China has been following some unusual trade policies that have led to a lot of exports to the United States, and some people are upset about that or concerned about what will go on long term vis-a-vis China. So those are issues that show that the general topic of international trade isn't going away, and as I said, we'll get to those issues in other lectures, but this lecture is just about the introduction to international trade and how economists think about it. There are some common biases against trade in the general public. It's often people confuse trade with sharing, and so there's this focus on fair trade. What's fair? But economists don't think of trade as sharing. We think of it as a voluntary transaction between consenting adults. So whenever we buy something from anybody for whatever purpose, what we're doing is we're trading, you know, our money for the goods or services because we think that the goods and services are worth it. So it isn't an issue of are they being fair or not, it's just a question of am I getting a good price? And if I'm getting a good price, I'll make the deal, and if I'm not getting a good price, I don't make the deal. And it's really, that's all there is to it. There is that you don't have to worry about fairness. If you think in terms of sharing, if you think in terms of having a collection of goods that's sitting there, you know, among your family or your clan, and you're going to try to divide them up, then you can worry about fairness. But when you're engaged in trade, you know, ordinary buying and selling, then the question of fairness really doesn't come up. It's just, you know, if it's a good price, you go for it. If it's a bad price, you don't, and you go somewhere else. And so economists think that that impersonal take-it-or-leave-it mentality is really what applies in international trade, not the family, you know, how are we sharing things view of the world. We don't think that should be applied to trade. Another bias against free trade comes from just anti-foreign bias. There's just this sense that any kind of intercourse with foreigners, any interaction with foreigners, is somehow dangerous. And I think that goes way back to the hunter-gatherer society and how we behaved in tribes. You know, if you look at primitive tribes, the reality is they are often quite violent, and they build up huge hatreds against one another. For some reason, human beings within tribes and clans seem to be programmed that when they see people from another tribe, they seem to want to commit theft, murder, rape, what have you, against people from the other tribe. And they build up fears of that the other tribe wants to do that to them. So there's this tremendous built-in xenophobia, that is, fear of the foreigner, that we have. And I think that shows up in some of the bias against foreign trade. So there's this fear that, well, the Japanese are different from us, and so they're doing bad things, or the Chinese are different from us, or the Arabs are different from us. This sense that you don't want to interact with someone from another tribe, or this fear of another tribe, I think is kind of at an emotional level what governs a lot of the bias against trade, or the concern with free trade. And then finally, there's make work bias, which is the belief that that jobs will go away, that there's a finite number of jobs, and if something happens to make some job go away, then the person, you'll be unemployed forever. And I think that's closely tied again to something else that's tribal, of the fear of the loss of status. I think people are very much afraid of losing status. And if you lose your job, that triggers almost a tribal sense of being banished into the wilderness. Just a really primal fear. Not that losing jobs should be fun or is a good thing, but in a way, the destruction of jobs is important to the growth of the economy. That is, if the same jobs were always there, that would mean that there's never any improvements in productivity. And so there's never any improvement in the standard of living. So in order for the standard of living to improve, jobs have to change. That is, people have to, and if you look at it historically, you can see huge changes. Probably 300 years ago, over 90% of people were in agriculture. Now, in the United States, about 2% of the people are in agriculture. So we lost a huge number of agricultural jobs. But turn that around, what that means is 2% of the people are now producing enough food to feed everybody, in fact, to export food. So that's a tremendous gain in productivity. And but part of that process has to be people leaving the farms in droves. And there's a good chance that your great-grandparents, that if you look at what your great-grandparents did, it includes farming. There's much less chance that your parents are farmers. And that represents economic progress, but it's pro but to but to get that progress, people have to adopt new occupations. People had to leave the farms, go into manufacturing, and then over the last, 50 to 75 years, they've gone out of manufacturing and into services. And so the jobs have become less physically demanding, less physically risky, less painful. People have had to work fewer hours. So all this is really to the good, but if you think of it just in terms of any time a job is lost, that means that somebody's going to be unemployed forever. If you think of it that way, then any progress that reduces jobs can be frightening. And that includes trade, because trade does have that effect. Okay, next topic is the history of free trade theory. Actually, I'm not going to go through the whole history. It's really quite long and quite distinguished, but I want to mention two economists from sort of slightly before and right around 1800, Adam Smith and David Ricardo. Adam Smith's view of trade was that it created larger markets, which made it easier for people to specialize. And he wrote that specialization allowed people to be efficient. So if you had a pin factory and you divided the job for making pins into a bunch of different jobs, so different people specialized, they would make pins more efficient, and they would make them more efficiently. And That view, he argued, meant that if you allowed more trade, more international trade, you would get more specialization, and more specialization would mean you're more efficient. The next view of trade theory comes from David Ricardo, and he's the one who developed the theory of comparative advantage. Now, you remember we've talked about comparative advantage, for example, with a surgeon. Why doesn't a surgeon mow her own lawn, even though she may be very efficient at mowing her lawn? It's because she can make more money as a surgeon. So the opportunity cost for her for mowing a lawn is higher than the opportunity cost of someone she could bring to she, that that someone she could pay to mow her lawn. Well, this concept of comparative advantage of spending more time working on the things that you're more efficient at and more productive at, relatively more efficient at, that concept also applies internationally. So even if one country is more productive at producing everything than another country, it is not the case that one country should produce everything and not trade with the other country. So here's the example that Ricardo gave. This is the workers that were required per unit of output. So Portugal requires fewer workers to produce wine, and it also requires fewer workers to produce cloth. And so you think, well, Portugal's better at everything. Why should they trade with England? Well, they can trade with England because if Portugal produces wine, they can produce that really cheaply and trade it to England for cloth. And the relative price of cloth will be lower that way. That is, Portugal can get more cloth by trading with England than it can by reducing its wine production and putting some of its own people to work for cloth. So that's the the concept of comparative advantage, which again makes it's intuitively obvious when you think of it without worrying about international trade. That is, why do surgeons not mow their own lawns? Why do lawyers not paint their own houses and so on? That's because somebody else has a comparative advantage in doing that. It's easier to trade for that. It's more efficient to trade for the good than it is to do it yourself. And that same principle of it being more efficient to trade than to do it yourself applies at a country level. In this sense, economists think of trade as like a technology. It isn't a form of sharing. It is a more efficient way of producing. You make an economy more efficient by trading so that you engage in the goods and services that for which you have a comparative advantage. And then you trade for the goods and services for which other countries have comparative advantage. And there's always a comparative advantage. In Ricardo's example, we would say that Portugal has an absolute advantage in producing both wine and cloth. That is, all else equal, Portugal can produce wine more efficiently than England and cloth more efficiently than England. That's called absolute advantage. It's possible for one country to have an absolute advantage in several products or in everything, but it is not possible for a country to have comparative advantage in both things. In this case, Portugal has a comparative advantage in wine. That means England has a comparative advantage in cloth, and that's always true. One country always has a comparative advantage in one. If there were just two goods, then one country always has a comparative advantage in one, and the other country always has a comparative advantage in the other. If you have two roommates who are sharing chores, laundry or washing dishes or drying dishes or vacuuming or whatever, one of them will always have a comparative advantage in doing some chores, and the other one will have a comparative advantage in doing other chores. It's not the case that one of them should sit on the sofa the whole time and the other one do all the work just because the other one can do all the work more efficiently. The most efficient thing to do is to find the things that one roommate has a comparative advantage in, and that the other roommate has a comparative advantage in, and allocate the work that way. So trade, in that sense, works like technological innovation. Okay, trade is an analogy with technological innovation. And so you'll see all the benefits of technological innovation and all of the worries created by technological innovation are associated with international trade. That's the way economists think about trade. It's, think of it as a technology, as an innovation. So if you introduce the possibility of trade, that's like a technological innovation. So when the internet comes along and allows us to do outsourcing, that is like a technological innovation. It's like going from digging dirt with spoons to using shovels to using power shovels, steam shovels. As you progress along that path, you produce more output for a given amount of labor, and the economy gets more efficient. So economists think of trade as working that way. It allows you to produce output more efficiently. It raises the standard of living on average. But as with any technological innovation, if somebody has a job that's tied to the old technology, then they're going to have to shift in response to the new technology. Okay, so let's move on. I want to sort of emphasize this concept of comparative advantage because it's really central in economics and certainly central to our view of international trade. I'm going to give some illustrations from various professors of economics. Alan Blinder, who was at Princeton, wrote this. He said, "Many of us have our shirts laundered at professional cleaners rather than wash and iron them ourselves. Anyone who advises us to protect ourselves from the unfair competition of low-paid laundry workers by doing our own wash would be thought loony." So his point is that we use these kinds of services all the time, every day. We buy bread from a baker rather than bake it ourselves. We have our shirts laundered rather than doing it ourselves. And we don't think at all about trying to protect ourselves from the fact that that these people can do it cheaper than we could do it ourselves. We think it's wonderful. So that's one illustration of comparative advantage. David Friedman. "There are two ways we can produce automobiles. We can build them in Detroit or we can grow them in Iowa. Everyone knows how we build automobiles. To grow automobiles, we first grow the raw material from which they're made, wheat. We put wheat on ships and send the ships out into the Pacific. They come back with Hondas on them." So that gets at the idea that trade is a technology, that it allows us to do something that we're very good at, let's say growing wheat, and and then in return get something that maybe we're not as good at, we're not as good as the Japanese at building automobiles. So that's it works like a technology. It's a production technology. And then another illustration that I use just to get the idea that absolute advantage is not the same as comparative advantage. It could be the case that Derek Jeter, who's the shortstop for the Yankees, is a better fielding first baseman than Jason Giambi, who's their first baseman. In fact, I would bet that's true. Jeter is a great athlete, has great defensive instincts, is very quick, probably could play first base better than Giambi. But we would say that Giambi has a comparative advantage at first base because the last thing you'd want to do is put Jeter at first base and then have to have Giambi at shortstop. They both have to play some position, and you're better off putting Giambi at first base and Jeter at shortstop. So that's an example of comparative advantage. We'd say that Giambi has a comparative advantage at first base. Okay, then let me move on to some of the arguments against free trade, some of which are legitimate, some of which are not. One is free trade creates winners and losers. That tends to be true. Just in the same way that technological innovation creates winners and losers. If we didn't import Japanese cars, then American auto workers and American auto manufacturers could make more higher profits and higher wages. So in some sense, they become losers when we open up to free trade. And it's because there are these specific losers that it's easy to get political impetus for protectionism. So we've had steel quotas as recently as a few years ago. The Bush administration put on steel quotas. Again, that was because the potential losers from imports of steel, like American steel workers and manufacturers, were able to lobby politically to get protection. But in general, economists think that it's more important to allow free trade to occur and find other ways to protect losers rather than protectionism. It turns out that the if you put on things like tariffs or quotas, you end up costing the economy maybe tens of thousands of dollars for every thousand of dollars that actually ends up, you end up improving the target group. So if the average steel worker gained $1,000 from tariffs, then the average American citizen might have lost $10,000. So it's a very expensive way of protecting the losers, and we think there ought to be we ought to look for cheaper ways of protecting losers than putting up barriers to trade. Another complaint is this issue of lost jobs. Again, there's no such thing as permanently losing a job. What happens is that there are some people who are going to have to shift out of some jobs into other jobs. And again, historically, that's gone on at an accelerating pace as people moved out from agriculture to manufacturing, now a big move out from manufacturing to service jobs. And now we're going to see, even within the service industries, a lot of turnover in jobs. In the textbook, there's a chapter called Progress and Displacement, where I talk about how people might have to leave the music industry, particularly some clerks at record stores. If online music sales continue to take off, you'll see fewer jobs in record stores, but more jobs being created in industries like healthcare. So the thing to do will not be to try to hang on to any existing job or existing career path, but to be adaptable and to be able to take on new jobs and new careers over time. Another argument against free trade is that somehow it's going to drive down wages, that if we have to compete with workers in India, that our wages will go down to their level. And that's something economists don't believe happens. In fact, lots of studies show that it doesn't happen, and our theory says that it doesn't happen. Our theory says instead that what determines your wage is your productivity. So if American workers are highly productive, they're going to earn a lot. And what happens as we open up trade with India is that Indian workers start to become more productive and their wages go up. And we've seen that happen. In fact, in some cases, it's happened so rapidly that it's slowed down the outsourcing trend. That India is having a hard time finding cheap labor that's capable of doing the types of jobs that we want to outsource. Computer programmers have seen their incomes rise dramatically in India. So in general, it does not drive down wages, although in a specific industry, it might for a short period of time, because all of a sudden you are competing against somebody who previously was earning less. But in general, the determinants of wages in America are American productivity, not the foreign level of wages. Okay, so what are the main lessons to learn from this introduction to trade? I think the main thing is to understand thoroughly the principle of comparative advantage. Make sure you understand what it means, how it operates, and how it operates internationally. The second thing is that trade is a form of technological efficiency. So economists don't think of trade in terms of sharing, in terms of us versus them, in terms of war. You may hear the term trade war. Well, economists never think in terms of trade as a form of warfare. It is a form of technological efficiency. It's a more efficient way of producing things. Going back to David Friedman's example, it's a way to produce automobiles more cheaply by growing them, as he says, by producing some other good and trading it for automobiles, you become more efficient at it. And the final thing is that all of this applies across borders. We would talk about comparative advantage and trade as a form of technological efficiency within the United States and across the United States, and it makes absolutely no difference. The principle of comparative advantage doesn't stop at the border. Technological efficiency from trade doesn't stop at the border. Everything applies across borders, which is why economists tend to favor free trade.